Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm Ailey Packham and we are drawing the line in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Well, last Sunday, it was a case of so close and yet so far as we let a two-goal lead slip as Southampton came back to grab a draw at the Amex. It was a point, however, that saw us draw level with our Premier League record points tally, and with four games to go, hopefully with a fair win, we can surpass it starting today at Wolves. Also this week, we saw the 25th anniversary of the final game at the Goldstone, and of course, that game at Hereford. Joining me today as we cast a night over all things Albion is, of course, Alan Wares. And we're delighted to welcome back on loan from Seagull Social, it's Ryan Adsett. And for the first time this season, it's the effervescent Matthew Potter. Welcome back to the show, boys. Lovely to see you as ever. Starting with you, Ryan, how's the season been for you since we last spoke?
Yes, mate. Thank you for having me on again. It's been up and down season, isn't it, really? It's been one of those seasons where if you asked me a couple of weeks ago, I'd have said awful. If you ask me now, I'm going to say pretty good. I think that's pretty much the general take of most Brighton fans, but I think we can all agree that Hyper Turk's the best away kit in recent history.
So hang on, Ryan, you're putting absolutely everything down to the kit and nothing to do with the quality of the players or the genius of the management.
Yeah, I think any away game that you've been to this season has been a cracker if you're wearing the Hyper Turk. But no, full credit to Graham Potter, of course. He's been fantastic for us. But no, Hyper Turk, I love it. It's been brilliant. Yeah.
Matthew, obviously, it's quite possibly going to go down as our best season in the top flight ever in terms of where we finish. But, you know, when you look at it, we lost six games in a row. We've drawn 14 games. It's just a bit weird, isn't it?
It is. Thanks for having me on again. Nice to see you both. It's like a game of two halves a bit, isn't it? Because it's like if you go to the away games, you've had an all right season. In fact, quite entertaining. If you just went to the home games, I would imagine you'd be pretty suicidal by now. I've had the COVIDs, so the last couple of weeks I haven't been able to go. So I've been watching on no longer dodgy streams. It has to be very good streams. The one I was watching for the Southampton game, whoever was commentating on that in whichever dodgy country it was coming from, came up with a stat, and he said Brighton at home, and said they've scored less goals than any other team in the Premier League. And then he said, oh, and the Championship. Oh, and League One. Oh, and League Two. Oh, and actually the top five divisions in Europe.
Wow.
So if that stat is correct, which I'm assuming it is, we've scored the lowest number of goals at home of any team in Europe this season.
I don't know. I sat in front of some of these people commentating for the foreign streams, and they're getting their stats from somewhere on the dark web, I think.
It's not going to be far off either way, but the point is still kind of valid. I mean, those two goals last week might have made a difference, but at that time, I think it was 11 goals, something like that.
Boring Brighton.
You know that, but it's at a point, isn't it? Is, you know, you think how many people you go. You know, we go away, but there's only 3,000 of us going away. There's 31,000 people whose season has been, I would imagine, really very not very good value for money or very enjoyable.
It's interesting your point you're making there, AD, about you know, losing in the middle of that run. You know, losing six in a row. I've just looked at our previous best, which is obviously the 81-82 season, exactly 40 years ago. And what didn't help us is we were kind of floating around mid-table, you know, sort of 8th, 9th, 10th. And then what really didn't help us, and we now prove that it's not going to happen, is that we actually lost five in a row, and seven of our last eight games were all defeats. In complete contrast to what had gone the year before, where we won our last four games and managed to scrape ourselves back over the line. It's the nature of us being in this top division that we can't hit any stride of consistency, or if we can, it's consistently awful. But the whole thing about scoring the goals is something we've been looking at for the last 2 years. And yet, I mean, I... you're saying about the when you're watching the Albion at home, yes, you're not getting to cheer too many goals. I mean, in theory, we parched four against Southampton, but you know, but we've also seen at times some really attractive football and kind of football that in 40 years of watching the Albion that you haven't really seen. You know, it's one thing when you're playing against a League One side when you're in League One and turning them over and sticking five past them. But when you're talking about competing with the likes of Liverpool, and not necessarily Man City, but when you're competing with them, some of the biggest clubs in Europe, you get to realise that there is a... Everything has to be in context. And whilst you wouldn't necessarily pick out any given player as being the best ever for the club right now, if that same player or if that same squad was in the Championship right now, and certainly in League One, you'd say, oh, wow, best ever. So everything has to be seen in context. Yeah, I think it's the stats that are going to tell us that we've had the best season ever, but certainly not necessarily the most enjoyable.
Ryan, did you first start watching the Albion with Dean or at the Amex?
With Dean, just about. I'm 21, so I saw the last couple of years of the with Dean. But yes, mostly most of my memories are going to be Amex, because you know that's when I started really getting into football.
Yeah. So in regards to, I mean, Al was just saying we've seen possibly some of the best football we've ever seen the Albion play. I mean, in your memory, I mean, is this the best team you've ever seen?
Yeah, quality wise, 100%. I mean, you know, we've got the likes of Kukurea and Alex McAllister, etc. The quality is a lot better. But yeah, you're right in saying it's been a weird season, because I suppose you're up against better sides. So you know, teams around us have gotten better. The likes of Villa, etc., have gotten better. So yes, it's been the best team I've seen, but we're also competing against better sides, which makes us not feel as though maybe it is.
Yeah, Matt, I mean, again, you've seen some sparkling football over your time watching the Albion. I mean, what's the best Albion team you've ever seen?
Well, the most enjoyable was winning the league, that League One season, without a doubt.
Yeah,
The Gus team.
The Calderon scoring 8 goals of the season, that one.
Mostly with his face, yeah.
That one. I think that the thing, it's undoubtedly true that we've got the best players that we've ever had. But Al, when you talk about the quality of football, it's undoubtedly true we've got talented players who can pass the ball around and play lovely football. But at some point in your measurement of quality football has to come end result of.
Absolutely.
And that to me, certainly at home, has been absolutely lacking. And there are two things that I think about this. One is the difference between our home and away form. Away, when we have a plan to take apart another team, it seems to work well. You know, Potter's undoubtedly tactically sound. He's, you know, he analyzes other teams. He works out a way of taking the game to them and beating them. A really fantastic example of that recently was that Spurs game, where he played 6 in the midfield, completely nullified the Spurs game, and we won. It was absolutely outstanding. But at home, we have not developed a identity and a form and a game of our own that we can take to other teams. You know, we are the ones who are supposed to sort of command the thing. And part of the problem for that for me is that, going back to that, is we had a better strike force in League One than we've got now.
Do you think a big problem with that though comes confidence? You know, at home it seems as though we just don't have that confidence. You know, I don't know what it is about the Amex. It's just
we don't have that confidence.
No, it's very different than the Amex. The atmosphere is very different to even what it was a couple of years ago. I mean, it's something that Graham Potter struggled with since he's come in. It is turning that Amex into the fortress that once was. But yeah, confidence I think is the biggest problem. I mean, tactically, usually we're pretty good. It's just, I think we seem to just go missing when it comes into the final third at home.
Yeah.
I mean, there's only really two games this season where we haven't really turned up at home, which is the Villa and the Burnley game.
And the Everton game, AD, we were poor. I mean, if you consider where Everton are now.
I'll give you the Everton one. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, if we're going to be in the Premier League and we've got 19 games at home, all right, we've had, 17 so far. And right, you're naming 4 bad ones. That means 13 reasonable ones, where, as in your parlance, AD, we've left points out on the pitch.
Sure.
And we arguably did against Southampton. certainly did against Norwich, and on and on and on. I mean, the one of the great things about the away performances is we've had a lovely, lovely time in London this year. Especially, you know, it's probably only worth turning up to pay after 80 minutes, because before that, it's just not worth it.
I mean, the stats are 15 points in London, 16 points at home.
Wow, yeah. that's mad.
Hang on. How many games did we play in London?
Seven.
Right, what's the one I'm missing then? So we're talking West Ham, Spurs, Arsenal, Chelsea, Brentford,
Palace. So,
No, it's 12 maybe points 12. From London. Sorry?
12, I think.
Unless you count Watford.
Yeah, Watford. Yeah.
Watford's Hertfordshire, isn't it?
It depends who you speak to. Well, let's include Watford. I think I must have included Watford when I was doing that. So, it's an amazing stat that, yes, that we're picking up that amount of points on the road. I mean, I think it's seven wins on the road. Four? Is it four at home?
Yeah, we still got that. Is it seven win jinx? Nine win jinx every year. We seem to hit nine wins, and we can't. I think every single season in the Premier League so far, we've had nine wins. Right now, we're sat on nine, I believe, which is it's just unbelievable to think. And we really haven't actually got over nine wins.
The really sad thing for me is I had the grandfather's delight. Grandson number two gets interested in football, wants to go to the Amex. So we go to the Amex, and after about 4 weeks where he's not seen us score a goal and seen us lose every game, he's lost interest in football.
That's not reason enough to get a new striker, I don't know what it is.
Which is really tragic. And the other thing that I think, because I don't believe any of this guff, but when you look at the sort of Paul Barber approach to football, where it's a product and it's entertainment and it's blah, 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 they're not serving it up.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's just the thing. I mean, I do buy that to a certain degree, Matt, because obviously with the home performances, although the performances have been largely okay, like I was saying earlier, people remember wins, and more people watch us at home than they do away. And, you know, we get on this verge of like breaking this points tally record in the Premier League. I think we got 52 in the old First Division, which was the record then. And that's the one we should really be looking to chase down. But, you know, people will remember the games at home, because more people will see those. And people that have been to the away games and seen those brilliant wins at Spurs, at Arsenal, the last ditch game at Brentford. That, I mean, even Neil Maupay scoring that goal at Palace, which felt like a win. Mm. You know, it's only 2,000 to 3,000 people are seeing those games. So it's not the 31,000 we've got at home. And you know, and not everyone's going, and not everyone's going to be watching Moody.
Well, you do get some that are on the telly, not all of them, but some that are on the telly. And I know what you're saying is that you don't get to see the performance. I mean, you know, against Crystal Palace, I'm glad the 31,000 didn't see it, because up there until the last minute, we were awful.
Yeah.
West Ham actually were a lot better than they used to be. They still haven't beaten us, but you know, they're a lot better than they used to be. But it's great when you can celebrate that last minute goal. You know, why'd you let it bounce? Oh, you know, it's the phrase of the season. But you know, people do get to see it. I mean, how many people who, you know, couldn't go to Spurs, you know, but sat and watched in utter awe that performance.
But then you could say though that's a confidence thing, as I said earlier, with the home form. I mean, I don't think, you know, if you've got 30,000 fans, which probably would have been 22,000 fans by the 85th minute, if they're all booing and getting upset with the team, I couldn't see Neil Maupay scoring in the 95th minute at home, because I don't think he'd have the belief to do it. At Palace, we've still got 3,000 or 4,000 fans with us. I was at Palace, and it's, you know, we still keep singing even when we're probably not playing that well. Mm. I think that's what gives these players the belief to go on and do it. At home, I just don't think that belief's there.
Okay. Yeah, but I'll agree with you. I'll get the confidence thing is undoubtedly true. But sure, that's where we are now.
Yeah.
We've got an Amex crowd that's silent or negative, and we've got a team that lacks confidence. But we've arrived at that point. That's not where we started. So
yeah, but I'd say, you know, we've had that for a lot of Potter's career, to be fair, because the new style of play begged a lot of question marks over the whole playing out from the back thing, which had a lot of fans questioning his style of play. Whereas with the Championship days, it was very end to end, and it kept fans a lot more entertained.
That's true, but it's still just to say the crowd and confidence is not sufficient for why we're not winning at home.
Mm.
We're doing something tactically.
Well, this is it. I think for me, the siege mentality of playing away, which I think the players seem to revel in a bit more, rather than the, I won't say it's a home comfort, but the siege mentality of when they're playing away and still keeping going. And keeping going for a noisy 3,000 that actually are appreciating, I think, a lot more than what the 30,000 are doing in expectation rather than hope and appreciation. So there's that kind of siege mentality that they seem to plug into. But I think your point about tactically aware as well, we're expected to take the game to another. Now, when you're playing the lower place teams, yeah, you're expected to do that, and we probably will do that. And what do? They then park the bus, with the exception of Burnley. Thanks a lot, Sean. But they, you know, they and we don't. We haven't worked out a way of. If we're going to play against a team that's got eight defenders there permanently, whether it's Arsenal, who won't do that, or Norwich, we're going to struggle. So, you know, we play best against teams that play open.
Yeah.
So when we're playing against a lower team that we'd be expecting to get some points against, you know, we can't break down that, or we can't break them down yet. We haven't worked out a way of doing so. And that's, you know, I wouldn't say it's naivety on Potter's part, but, you know, somewhere down the line, he's worked out how to do that. But still only in his third year as a Premier League manager, it will come.
Yeah.
But when it comes to playing the big teams, you know, we seem to get that much more about, out of it, because we are a team that actually prefers, I think, open games.
I mean, actually, I mean, but I mean, going back to the atmosphere at the ground, though, I mean, I don't think it was actually that bad on Sunday. I mean, it usually only takes a bad referee or something for everyone to get their backs up and actually start to be a little bit more vociferous. But I mean, it wasn't the worst I've ever seen. And it only takes one go. I mean, we all look back and we say the day that the Amex came of age was that Sheffield Wednesday playoff game, where it was just absolutely electric, the atmosphere in there. It was the loudest it's been before or since. But, you know, but for the rest of that season, the noise level was pretty much maintained. It was amazing. But I mean, it helps that the team was on the crest of a brilliant promotion. But it was.
But also, this is chicken and egg, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's.
Oh, the crowd lifts the players. The players lift the crowd. The crowd lift the players. The players lift the crowd. And it's a. I can never remember the phrase here, but when you've got sort of two things that need to feed off each other in order to thrive and survive, and you get that with an away crowd because they're that much more boisterous.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about our 14th draw of the season, and it was a fast start. A goal in 2 minutes, and the slick football in the build up to that goal was absolutely wonderful to watch.
Ryan, do you want to go with this, mate?
Yeah, it's a great game. Great first half, should I say. The way we started was impressive, and we were clinical, and we were having shots on target. And Danny Welbeck, although it was an open goal, scored. And to be honest, it was it got the crowd off their feet, as we've just been mentioning about the atmosphere. As I say, it was quite good in that first half. We took the game to them as we probably expected they would, but I think what was a bit more disappointing was the fact that everyone knows that Southampton have the potential of capitulating. As soon as they go two goals down, I was thinking, look, they could be here for a drilling. I think we had a lot of chance in that first half, which we probably should have taken. There was an easy chance to dead and bury them that time.
I've got to say that, I mean, yes, they do have that capacity to do that, but they were very much in the game, even at 2-0 down. And, you know, I mean, they hit the post. It was, former Albion target, Tino Livramento, who we'll talk about in a minute. He hit the post. It was end-to-end, and we left ourselves open a few times. But it was just such a...
Probably for the neutral, but it was an exciting game. It's a game that we could have, should have closed out in the first half. I mean, I don't think anyone's got any problems or queries with the offside goal given, certainly the first one given.
Not the first one, the second one I definitely did.
Well, hang on a second. Let's talk about the first half for now. Like, you know, the thing is, we were the better side and for the most of it. But, you know, there were patches when Southampton then rallied. But then, you know, with people saying, oh, Southampton were so much the better side in the second half. I don't think so. I thought there was kind of 5 minutes of Southampton attacking, and it was 5 minutes of Brighton attacking, and then 5 minutes. And of course, you know, us not being neutrals, Southampton are attacking better than us because we're worried about our goal being breached. Whereas, you know, when we're attacking, we're not getting that excited or that scared because we're not that good up front. But actually, if you had a neutrals hat on, I think that you realise that actually, you know, both sides had chances to win it. So, you know, it's not a game that could have finished 9-all, don't, you know, by any stretch of imagination. But, you know, Southampton didn't give us the hiding that a lot of people thought they did.
Now, I mean, the goal scorer, of course, was Danny Welbeck for that one. And
are you going to start crying?
Well, he's been blowing a little bit hot and cold of late. I mean, he's been instrumental in a lot of the goals that we have scored, even when he's not been playing well. But on Sunday, he really played well.
First half, I thought it was superb. You know, all right, there he was. You'd like to think that as a sniffer, he would be there. I mean, he's a sniffer and knows how to score from the edge of the area. But you'd like to think, let's put it this way, if there was no one in there to have actually, you know, picked up that, and it was a defensive foul-up, you know, between the defender and the goalkeeper, you know, you'd be furious. And actually, probably earlier in this season, there might not have been someone there. You know, Mopai might have been there wearing, you know, and the next person sort of outside the box. So it's good we've got the sniffer there.
Yeah.
I will say this, Cucurella's cross was probably one of the worst he's put in. And don't forget, he's put some rubbish ones in.
Well, first goal, really, I disagree with that. What he did, he actually put the ball into the corridor of uncertainty, and it was there for someone to, like, attack. And
I think he mishit it. It was a P-roller, and Forster should have had that easily, but there was a miscommunication with his defender. You know, Forster should have actually just sort of thrown his hat on it.
Yeah,
but whether he had a hat or not,
I'm not having that. I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah, that's exactly the ball he should have been putting in all season.
It's exactly the right ball he put in, but poorly done.
I mean, we love Cucurella, he's a very, very strong bet to be named player of the season. But my God, can he not shoot? And his final ball quite often leads something to be lacking. But when he put that ball, like I said, into the corridor of uncertainty, you could see the fear in the defenders and the goalkeeper's eyes because no one knew. Oh, after you. No, after you. And it was like, it was just there.
Hey, calm down.
Your glorious show sponsor, Phil, sits in front of me at the football every so often, I have a rush of blood to the head and ask him to use his betting app to put a tenner on Cucurella to score for me. Because there has got to come a point, surely. How many times in a game does he get himself in a position where he could?
Yeah. I mean, we quite often talk about 50p heads. He's got a 50p foot in front of the goal.
Well, don't forget, he can go send that near post while his hair is still at the far post.
Well, his hair nearly ruled somebody onside at Arsenal, but it was...
He can't cross and he can't... Well, he did get a crossing, but his crossing is actually sort of notoriously sloppy. It's his defending, which, let's face it, is his first priority, which is excellent. His raiding down the wing is excellent.
That's really strange, isn't it? Because when he came, everyone said he's an attacking player who can't really defend.
I thought he's defending. I mean, you know, he's very rarely skinned, is he?
Yeah.
No.
Apart from the free kick that he gave away.
This is the point, Aid, is that as much as we're congratulating Welbeck on a great game, I've got to say, I mean, if this was Cucurella's, 35th game for us, I'd say it was his 35th best game for us. Because, you know, he I won't say he had a mare, but he wasn't the Mark Cucurella that we all know and love already.
Okay. Well, let's just have a quick look at the second goal. And the one thing that was wrong about this goal for me was the fact that I wish it wasn't an own goal because Danny Welbeck started that move. And it was pretty much like an expansive 1-2 of sorts. He played with Trossard, and that ball from Trossard back in was an absolute peach, and the defender didn't know what to do with it. But I just wish it had have reached Welbeck for him to finish that move that he started, and it would have been goal of the season for me.
I mean, this is what Welbeck brings, isn't it? Oh, sorry, yeah, you go.
I was going to say, either of you. I'm just thinking, actually, with all that, it started by him doing some defensive duties.
I think Welbeck brings just a lot of quality. I mean, you could say he's a sniffer or even a shooter from outside the box, but I think he brings a lot of quality. The touch he had to bring it inside, and then the ball to Trossard to start the counter attack off. It's the quality that he brings. I mean, there's a reason why he's played for these big sides, you know. And I think a big part of his career has been his injuries. But when he's played, he's got the quality about him. It's just a shame he's hampered by injuries, because I don't think he'd be with us if he wasn't.
No, you're probably right. He probably still, if it wasn't for the injuries, he'd probably still be playing for England as well.
I'm going to say, I think, Matt, that it's been so long since you've been on the Raw that you're probably Welbeck signed since you've last been on. So what do you make of the qualities that he brings to the side?
Well, pretty much what Ryan was saying. There are touches that he has that are a cut above, really, aren't they? You can see that there's a really very classy player there. I like the way that he, one of the things I really like about him is the space that he finds.
Yeah.
You know, he reminds me very much at the end of his career. I saw Martin Peters playing for Norwich. Sorry about this, Ryan, this is years before. But
before me, mate, so.
I saw Martin Peters right at the end of his career playing for Norwich. And the outstanding thing about him was, he was always in space. He always found this space. And he's like, how does he do that? Mm. And Welbeck's got a bit of that as well. You see, it's just, I think he's a really lovely player and we're lucky to have him. Mm. He's a pleasure to watch. How much he brings to the team is limited, I think, by two things. One is the obvious one, injury. And the other one, I'm sorry to say, is the players around him.
Yeah.
I think with a better strike partner, we'd be absolutely raving about him.
Okay, well, yes. We're going to come on to that a little bit later on. But before we move on, obviously, we've got to talk about, I mean, James Ward-Prowse, we gave away that free kick. Obviously, we should have cleared that long before it got to that point. I mean, there's quite a lot of sloppy play from us throughout the game. And there was some sparkling stuff, but there's some really, we gave the ball cheaply. We know that it takes Adam Webster a long time to get back up to speed when he comes back from a long injury, so that wasn't a surprise. But I mean, that foul that Cucurella made, he didn't need to make that foul because it should have been cleared long before that. But the free kick itself, Ward-Prowse, we know he's an expert. I mean, it wasn't a great free kick, really, even, was it?
Went in.
I mean, the wall was absolutely awful.
I thought Sanchez was at fault there, because I don't think Sanchez didn't look like he trusted that wall, and he wasn't covering the part he should have been covering.
It went through a hole in it and bounced before it went in. It was like...
He caught everyone off guard, didn't he? Went the wrong way. Well, he went the other way, should I say. Sent everyone the wrong way. But I think that... I mean, I've looked back on sort of James Ward-Prowse's free kicks. Everyone knows he's an expert, as you say, but he always goes keeper's side. So, does that come down to a bit of lack of real research on how James Ward-Prowse takes free kicks? We know he can hit them, but he took everyone off guard.
Having seen Ben Roberts in action... No, that is not the case very much.
Yeah, we'll never know. But yeah, here we are.
I mean, the attention those guys have to detail is second
to
none.
Well, it's kidology, isn't it?
He would have had all the intel. So anything on the pitch that they would have been having strong words with him afterwards, because, we've been there with Ben behind us a few times, and he's been... You know, he's got his army of analysts with him, and he goes absolutely mental when he does something they've been told not to do.
That hole in the wall appeared because of the Southampton players. It wasn't a hole in, you know, we didn't create a hole in our own wall. They created that hole.
Yeah.
Sanchez was too far across behind his own wall.
Yeah. I mean, I think there was a bit of kidology about it. I mean, he wasn't centre. He was on the side, just on the side of the side it went in. I think it was kind of, but you could see his body leaning towards the bigger open space. It was to say, you know, I'm ready for you. And Ward-Prowse just turned him over like a nut. You know, it was...
If you're facing a Ward-Prowse free kick, I mean, obviously it's unlikely I'm going to be, but I would imagine if you're facing a Ward-Prowse free kick, you have to trust your wall.
Yeah. But if he's gone through a gap where Southampton is, then... So this either says something about the wall or not observing the fact. You think, hang on, there's a gap there. I really need to do something about this.
Okay. Before we move on, I mean, we've got to. Do you want to talk about the officiating, Al?
rubbish, wasn't it? But then it always is against Southampton.
We did want to take the Aussie referee's middle stamp at one point. It was
I felt about it was that there was an element of niggly play about Southampton. There was against Aston Villa as well. There was, and you know, we pass the ball and then someone would come on sort of push a player or nip him on the ankle or stuff like that. And not once. So in other words, Southampton got away with it 100% of the time. And there were times where a Brighton player was sort of kind of scared to look for a pass because he had someone closing in on him and knowing he was going to get clattered, not in a sort of, you know, horrific way. We also had the whole notion of players going down too easily. Whereas, you know, a couple of our players got completely upended. It's like Ryan's Hyperturk thing, thinking, you know, of if we're in that, we're going to be brilliant. My attitude is that every time we have, you know, we play Southampton, we're going to get a moody ref. And it's not all right. Don't get me wrong.
Every time we wear the yellow kit, we lose or don't win.
I don't think Southampton were that bad. I don't think they were as bad as Spurs, to be honest. I thought Spurs were horribly dirty at times. Get physical back at them. You know, if the ref's not going to, I mean, this is, football has changed so much, but surely it hasn't changed so much that if a team's getting niggly with you and physical, you don't do it. You just don't.
Was my point. As soon as Brighton did, then they got done for it. You know, and like I said, there were a couple of times.
That's just bias, isn't it? That's just your unconscious bias. Oh, we always get done for it. They never do.
No.
Okay, maybe. Well, let's talk about unconscious bias then.
No, it's not unconscious bias,
now,
believe me.
Now, Ryan, I know that you've got a major issue with the drawing of lines. And my major issue with this was the linesman was so desperate to, like, flag it offside, he actually fell over in the build-up to it, which was ridiculous.
Ryan, tell us what's on your mind.
It didn't feel right to me. I mean, I've looked at it back a lot of times. I've probably put about 3 tweets on about it as well. I probably annoyed a few people. But looking at it again and again and again, I still can't see how he's offside.
I can't.
I don't know how he's offside. To me, it looks like he's behind that line. So I don't know how he's offside. I don't know. I can't see for me the amount of times I've looked at it, how he's offside. And it was a cracking finish by Gross, by the way. Shut the haters up there.
Well, exactly. We're talking about Pascal Gross. How the hell has he got ahead of the last defender?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, he has to.
They should let him off.
Yeah. I just don't get how it's offside to me. I can't
see any single visual that I saw of it. He definitely wasn't offside.
No, and they didn't play it at the they meant to put it on the screens, and I didn't put it on the screens. And that, to me, just to put your tinfoil hat on a little bit, you think, why don't you put it on the screens? Why can I not see how that's offside? I don't know, but it's the Premier League.
Did they do that for the obvious one as well in the first half?
No, they didn't. No, but
do they get to see something that we haven't seen, or do we get to see everything?
Well, there's a couple of things here. The only freeze frame I've seen is, and this is something that's been the case since VAR. And where technology needs to improve is the frame rate. Now, what I've seen is, you know, they've got the position of the various players and the person who kicked it. And the person who kicked it is that the ball has probably left their foot by about a foot. And I'm guessing that the previous frame, he hasn't kicked it yet. So we've not got a perfect symmetry of when the ball was kicked. And if we're going to have to talk about tenths or hundredths or thousandths of a second, we're going to get to that minutiae, which we incidentally weren't supposed to be. I thought that was being done away with.
Exactly. That's the whole point. At the beginning of the season, it was done away with. And now when we saw those offsides that were by a toenail or by a gnat cube, it was like, you know, these things, they were meant to be doing away with that and giving the advantage to the attacker, but they've gone back on it.
Absolutely. But the only thing that I could ever say in a referee's defence, and I really shouldn't be doing this because I would happily stick them all on a bonfire, is that in real time, it was given offside. So
yes,
the lines,
I agree,
rightly
actually.
Or wrongly, the flag went up. Yeah. So VAR is looking at, should I overturn this? Mm. And the evidence was inconclusive. You're saying that the evidence is, you know, how can it be given? So the evidence is inconclusive. So you go with the on-pitch decision. If the linesman hadn't stuck his flag up and they were still looking at it, then the on-field decision is goal. And I think that if they'd have looked at it then, they'd have then gone, goal because we don't have a reason to give it offside.
This is the other argument, though, because I mentioned it earlier. In the build, basically, when the ball was played, the lino wasn't up with play because he fell over.
Well, that's another matter. To be honest, that's not VAR's issue.
Well, no, but,
does that make it right, then? Does it make it right that we're going with the on-pitch decision that's probably wrong?
No. And also this it invites linesmen with any doubt whatsoever, or just it's close, to put the flag up.
Yeah.
Because they, know it's
something they're not meant to do.
No, but they're going to, aren't they? They're human. Yeah. I mean, there's something as close as that, that one there. If you're a linesman, you're going to stick your flag up. Well, I don't actually know, but it's so close. I'm just going to stick my flag up and leave it.
Absolutely. I mean, in real time at that time, and bearing in mind I'm on the West Stand upper halfway line, about halfway back, my initial thought was that Gross was offside. And if I didn't have VAR or any screen or anything else to put that up with, then, all right, from my position, and I'm not level with the last defender, I'd have probably flagged him. Personally, that was my first impression. I didn't realize it was as close as it was. So when everyone else went up around me, I thought, I'm not going up because I'm pretty certain that's going to get given. I didn't realize it was as close as it was. But then you've got that point of, I suppose it has to be that the referee or the linesman has to know a given decision. And in his instance, he said, well, I know that bloke's offside. I'm giving it. Okay. It's a mare. It's very, very untidy. Especially when now we're supposed to be relying on VAR, which in itself is then inconclusive. The closest thing I can put towards this is when a cricket umpire gives out LBW and it's reviewed. And if there's any level of doubt one way or the other, you go with the on-field decision, whether it's out or not out. And this is the closest thing I can think as to what's happened here is that the linesman did flag and VAR was inconclusive. That's all I can... Apart from that, tosh.
But it wasn't inconclusive. Not what I saw. It wasn't inconclusive.
I don't think it was inconclusive.
You know, unless they saw something else.
Well, you said yourself, Ryan, I couldn't see how it was given. Does that mean to say that you're in your mind, Gross was definitely onside?
Yeah,
that's what I'm saying. I'm saying I can't see how it was offside.
On that note, it was we did add another point to the total. It's our record points. We equaled our record points tally in the Premier League. And you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. We are brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com, as mentioned by the wonderful Matthew Potter there earlier, and his friend he watches the games with. And we have a wonderful shirt of the week for you. And now, Al, what do you make of this one?
What do I make? Okay, basically, it's a white shirt. It's got AEK on the sleeves, which I think is actually a little bit of a red herring because it's not AEK of Athens. It's got a red square in the middle with the word Frutiger written across it. It's got Aspo, and I guess that's a secondary advertiser. It's made by Arima. I've never heard of them. I'm sure Phil will tell us that they're still better than Nike. And the other thing that made me think it was Swiss is because Frutiger is named after Adrian Frutiger, who was a typographer. I'm not sure if he's still alive, who invented the Frutiger typeface, quite commonly used around here, but specifically for the new signs at Charles de Gaulle Airport in 1970 when it was rebuilt. So, yes, that's my thing. And
I think it's my Swiss team, actually. I think it's an away shirt of FC Thun.
Yes, it is. And this is what Phil has to say about this one. Here's your shirt of the week, chosen because it will infuriate you and Alan will slobber over it. It is the 2009 to 2010 away shirt of Swiss side FC Thun. Far too serious to have a nickname. FC Thun play in the Swiss Challenge League, which is the second flight of football in Switzerland. The team was formed in 1898 and they play at the 10,000 capacity Stockhorn Arena in the city of Thun in central Switzerland. The team has had some history of playing in the top flight between 2002 and 2020. They maintained the status of as a top flight side before relegation in June 2020. They even managed to qualify for the Champions League in 2005, making it to the group stages before being seen off by the likes of Arsenal and Ajax. In 2019, the club was acquired by Xian Li, a Chinese-American entrepreneur and investor, and he has a penchant for European football clubs. He also owns Oostend, Nancy, Iceberg in Denmark, Den Bosch in Holland, and Barnsley. There's no one of real interest in the current squad. After an extensive read through a few lists of their past players, there's not a lot there either. The best he can do with a link to the UK is former Norwich defender Tim Closer. He played for Tim between 2009 and 2011. Played for Norwich between 2016 and 2021, making 117 league appearances, and he now plies his trade at Bristol City. He even tried to find something interesting about the city of Tun. Do you know anything about Tun, Matt?
No, I've never actually been there.
Phil couldn't find anything interesting about that either. The best he can do is that the club's sponsor, Frutiger, is not only the name of local construction company, but also based on the legendary font designed by
Adrian Frutiger.
To be fair, Thun have had variations on that away shirt a lot, so it's a fairly easy one. They've never had Hyperturk, they've just had dull
white. Okay, before we move on, we've just got one thing on the notice board. By the time you've heard this, the Rent first leg game will have been played out, but there is another charity match this weekend, which is at Withdean on Sunday. It's in aid of the Martlets Hospice, and an Albion Legends 11 will take on the Martlets team, who will be managed by Norman Cook, also known as Fatboy Slim, who you had a chat with, Ryan, a little while ago.
Yeah, what a guy. What an absolute legend Fatboy Slim is.
Yeah, and the Albion team's a bit of a who's who, not only the Albion, but who's been on the Roar, actually. But the likes of Gary Hart, Tommy Alphick, Peter Smith, John Keeley, even Steve Foster's turning out in this one. They'll all be donning the stripes one more time. Kickoff is, of course, at one of our old grounds at Withdean at 1:30, and entry is a fiver. It's quite a who's who here. I mean, even on the Martlet side, their coach is Sammy Nelson, who also used to play for us in Arsenal. Another coach of theirs is Paul Hayward, another former guest on the Roar here.
God, can Paul Hayward get about?
Yeah. But obviously Malcolm Stewart's involved. He's the physio. Russell Bromwich is the manager of the Legends team. But John Keeley, Kerry, Ian Chapman, Dodge.
It just occurs to me with all these names here, and I know it's something that was started or attempted to be started by our good friend Dan Tester. I just don't think he's had the opportunity or the time to be able to do this. Is there should be an Albion Old Boys Association. Because if nothing else, from this 25 years at the Goldstone, or since the Goldstone do last week, where, you know, you could clearly see how much playing for the Albion meant for those guys. You know, especially when we saw the class of 97, who was still fancy taking on West Street that night. A lot of them clearly haven't seen each other for a long, long time. And, yeah, I think that they probably just want to sort of be in touch with each other a little bit more. So if anyone's got any admin time and wants to actually set up, you know, and administer the Old Boys Association, I'm sure you get actually a lot of appreciation from someone.
Let's move on. OK, we've got a few players out of contract coming up, including a player we've just been eulogising about, Danny Welbeck, and also Pascal Gross. Two very important players to us this season. Will we be seeing them next season, Ryan?
Hopefully. I think we will see Danny, for sure. Whether we'll see Pascal, on the other hand, I don't know. I haven't seen anything to suggest he's staying on yet, I believe. I could be wrong. But no, I think Welbeck will probably sign. I like to hope anyway. I love both of them, really. I don't get the Gross hate at all. People don't like him because he's slow, but they completely ignore the fact he's our top chance creator and arguably best signing of the last 5-6 years. So I don't understand the hate towards him. And yeah. I do hope he stays on because...
Yeah. Matt?
Well, it's, the hate for Gross is ridiculous. He's always been slow.
Yeah. No, exactly.
It's not he's slowed down. He's just always slow. I'd like to see both of them back. Well, back without a doubt. The only thing I would say about Gross is, you know, we need to be working on a post-Gross world. But, you know, give him another year whilst we do that.
Yeah.
We've got to find an equally good dead ball specialist who is quite a fast runner. And I'm sure that there must exist, you know, maybe even hopefully might even have, you know, one or two of the kids coming through. Pascal Gross's dead ball stuff is second to none in the club.
And also we seem to have changed our midfield in the last few weeks, which is a forward looking thing. I think we're unlikely to see Bissouma here next year. So it's probably quite a good thing to keep him, I would have thought.
I mean, you're talking about a chance creator there as well, and a leading assist maker this season, even though he's been injured for large parts of it, is actually Enoch Mwepu.
Good point. I think Mwepu's just, I think, different level alongside Caicedo. I think they'll be important for us next few years. It's just whether, as you say, Mwepu keeps fit, because he does worry me the amount he gets injured, but no, he's breeds goals and assists.
Well, yeah. I think it's probably with him. It's just the step up from the demands of Austrian Football League versus the demands of the Premier League. And if you're not ready for it, it can probably be quite debilitating. Yeah. But yeah. So when we're talking about Gross and you're talking about Mwepu and what have you, obviously there is a difference between a chance creator and an assist thing. Because, I mean, you can put up the most delicious cross, you know, in the whole world that actually is just begging to be tapped in, and then, you know, Lallana will then stick it in Rose Ed. And of course, then that stat is then blown to smithereens. But the issue with Gross is, yes, he's great on the dead ball. And yes, when he's got a moment and he's crossing from deep. And this is something I'd like to see more of. And maybe it's just the fact that Potter doesn't like percentages, playing the percentages up front. But he can stick a mean ball in from deep as well. And I'd like to see still a little bit more of that.
Yeah, for sure. But, I mean, one thing that the club has been pretty hot on over the last couple of years is succession planning. Now, obviously, I mean, we didn't really get a replacement in for Ben White when he went, because we thought they were already at the club. But it turns out we sent the best options of that out on loan, and we've not, and hopefully they'll be back in the summer. But we've got a few players. I mean, obviously, the obvious ones are the ones that are out of contract this summer, which is Gross and Welbeck, but we've got a long list of players with only just 1 year left on their contract.
Such as?
And that worries me. So, I mean, the list is, obviously, Ibrahim, we know that. He's unlikely to be here past next season. If he is, brilliant. But if he is here, I would hope that he's here having signed a new contract. But Neil Maupay is out of contract. He's got a year left in his contract. Leandro Trossard, Alexis McAllister, Joel Veltman, Shane Duffy, Lallana still... and Roberts, they've all got 1 year left. Now, out of that, you would hope that we would try and retain at least Trossard, McAllister and Veltman.
Yes, I think they've all got something to offer. Sorry, say that again, Matt?
And two of those three are in my players of the season, so I would definitely hope.
Absolutely. And I think that also, another person you mentioned there, Lallana, I can see him probably wanting to wind down his career here. What is he, 33, 34 now? I can see this being his last club. Even when he's not playing, you can see the effect he has on the players around him. Like, as we've said many times on the show, AD, you know, when the stadium was empty, his was the voice you could hear most often. So he's one of those sort of noisy, chippy sort of players. So I'd like to think he's going to perform a Bruno/Glenn Murray type role, in as much as even if he doesn't get to play all the time, he's got something else to offer.
You have to look at your squad, don't you, and say how many Grosses, Welbecks, Lallanas are we prepared to carry in a squad? Three, then there's your three. But if it's not, then one of them has to go.
Absolutely. But I also say is that what effect? I mean, you know, as soon as Glenn Murray left the squad, look at the quality of the strikers that we've had. And I would love, not necessarily for him to have been taken up a space in the squad, but for him at least to have been around, to have actually, you know, helped the next person. He's not part of the training squad, and therefore he's not been able to learn the tricks and tips. Mopay and even Trossard are not necessarily learning the tricks and tips that Murray, as a 6-yard sniffer, could offer.
Yeah, but Trossard is improving exponentially. I mean, if you look at Trossard's improvement since we've had him, it's an upward graph, without a doubt. If you look at Mopay's, it's not.
I do tend to compare Trossard to Paul Brooker, though. He does disappear for large chunks of the season, and his form does fluctuate on a regular basis. But you're right, at the moment he's been absolutely brilliant.
But if you just look at what he can do on a football pitch now compared to what he could do when he came here.
He's always had the quality,
he's gone up a level.
He's definitely got a lot more consistency to his game now. He can drop deeper as well, which is a massive attribute.
And he's hard to shake off the ball. It's hard, you know, he's bulked up. He's hard to knock off the ball.
That's a recent thing, but yes. And his form has been great. Yes, I mean, I do take the point. I think that the Paul Brooker thing is a little bit harsh. Yeah, I know what you're saying, AD, that, you know, he only ever plays when the sun comes out, but the level of consistency, I think I'll go with Ryan's point, is it's about the level of consistency. Even when he started with us, you know, there'd be games where he could be anonymous and then do something amazing.
Yeah.
Or there'd be other games. I mean, I'm always thinking of a game back at Selhurst Park a couple of years ago. He had the freedom of Selhurst Park on the left-hand side and did absolutely diddly squat with it. And that's how frustrating he can be. However, if he had that now, I think he could cause mayhem.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably, you know, getting on the back of Matt's point of, yes, he has gone up a notch. And I think, but I still think actually genuinely there's more to come from him.
Well, we'll see what happens. But okay, well, let's move on. Obviously, we're celebrating or commiserating, depending on your viewpoint, the last game at the Goldstone, which was 25 years ago this week. Obviously, Ryan, long time before you were born. But I mean, obviously, you've seen like all the furore about it, and you've heard all the stories. What's your viewpoint on it all?
Yeah, I mean, my dad's been a fan since the 70s, you know, so Brighton's been in my family. It's, you know, it's not a new thing to me. So obviously, I feel and know the story and everything about it, and I understand everything to do with it as well. But yeah, obviously, it was sad how it went. But it's just like everything in life, isn't it? Eventually, everything has to move on. And I think if you look in hindsight now, you can say, look, it's happened and Brighton are in the best position they've ever been in their history and probably ever will be. And I anticipate it to only get better. So, you know, you look at it and you look back in hindsight now and you think it's just part of history and everything moves on. But yeah, obviously to go on it, I wasn't there to see it, but I wish I was.
Ryan, did your dad ever sit you on his knee and sort of tell you, you know, let me tell you about this war story, son?
Pretty much. I mean, since I can remember, I mean, I've been very well into Brighton. I mean, my dad literally is, you hate Palace as soon as you grow up, and that's about it. And then that's about it for the rest of your life.
But Ryan, I've seen it, not obviously not from yourself, but I've seen it from other people similar age to yourself, and saying, oh, why can't you just move on? But I mean, we'll bang the drum and say, no, we will move on, but it's important that we remember it.
For sure. Oh, yeah, no, I agree. You've got to remember it. I don't think you should forget your roots. That's one thing that should never happen. I think Tony Bloom's done a good job of that, keeping the roots to the club, because that's important.
Yeah, so, I mean, we've put it out on socials today. And what's your favourite Goldstone memory? I asked for the most... the more random, the better is the ones I've got. And I think I'm just scrolling through this now. There was a guy called Tom Wheeler. He said, he was sitting in the West End desperately trying to shush my dad, who was talking loudly about how useless Mark Farrington was and how he was delighted that he wasn't playing, unaware that Mark Farrington was sitting in the seat immediately behind him.
Well, that is quite funny, but actually, he probably deserved it, because, I mean, if ever we've had a kind of a waste of shirt and bones playing for the Albion, Mark Farrington, it didn't help that Barry Lloyd really hyped him up, saying he was better than Small and Byrne, which he clearly wasn't. Yeah, I mean, obviously, there's no need for that kind of level of personal abuse, unless you can level it at the likes of Archer and Bellotti, so...
No, this was Dan H. He says, watching Peter Grummett brilliantly save a point blank pile driver from Brian Talbot before Graham Cross slipped in to score a late winner and dumped Ipswich Town out of the League Cup in 1976. Phil Shelley, who's he?
Never heard of him.
He watched his first ever game v Norwich in 1979, watching the players warming up, and Fashanu, who was playing for Norwich at the time, was doing high kicks and he fell on his bottom. The cheers and jeers were my introduction to Tereshuma, and I still love it. And
Matt, tell us about any sort of Goldstone memories that you think Yeah, I wish I could have that repeated.
What I would say about it is that Ryan touched on this, is that, you know, it all turned out all right in the end. And it does give us that kind of unique history and bond and story. And, you know, and I can't remember who it was, might have been Chris Hughton, was it, who gave new players a copy of Burn a Bonfire when they arrived? So that they get the history of it and that this, that and the other. And it's an important thing. And I think if you look at the way our club is structured and the relationship we have with our club, which is by any club standards, but good, extraordinarily good, that I think that comes from that. So, all in all, whilst terrible thing. And if you think about it, we could still be playing in something that now resembles the Arthur Waite stand.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you could argue, you know, a cynic amongst you could actually say, well, what a visionary Bill Archer was. I mean, of course, that wasn't his plan, but, you know, he was the one that set this all in motion.
Yeah. I don't think that would go down very well if you put that on Twitter, that's for sure.
Okay, those that were there will see the irony.
More worrying to me was, did you say Phil Shelley doesn't like your dog?
Yeah. He's a weird one that way.
Yeah. Okay, just one more before we close. And this one, actually, you can actually hear the full story of this. Malcolm Stewart told us this story in full when he was on the show a while ago. But it was this was from Andy Message. It was the North Stand singing to Malcolm Stewart after his girlfriend turned down his proposal over the PA system at Old Trafford. And they all sang to him from the North Stand in unison. She said no.
But he then did actually say on the show it was the best thing that ever happened to him, that rejection.
Yes, he did. Okay, and that's all we've got time for this week. So thank you to Alan Wares, thank you to Matthew Potter and to Ryan Adsett. I've been Eddie Packham, and this has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast and in association with oldfootballshirts.com. We'll see you again next week. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Story of the blues. Story of the blues.
Don't you want to know that I think we're going to beat Wolves 2-0?
I said 2-0 as well. So do you know what? It's actually going to happen.
There goes my bloody dog.